Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Network Saturday, the 24th of January, 2015. This is episode 1155. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at gazelle.com. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet and home theater. You know, this is the fun part of the weekend. We get to talk about high tech, anything with a chip in it, kind of the toy store. I love that. 8888-ASK-LEO is my phone number if you want to call with a question, a comment, a suggestion. 888-827-5536. I say that slowly so that everybody gets it. But really, it's easy. 8888-ASK-LEO. You know, if you just want to remember one thing, remember the web site, because that's got the phone number there. It's got a link to our great chat room. It's got, you know, everything you need is right there. And that website, you ready? You got a pencil? Tech, this is the one you have to write down, techguylabs.com. You might even be able to remember that. See, I'm the tech guy, and then I'm in a laboratory. I'm wearing a white lab coat. I've got eye protection on. I've got a helmet on. Something's about to explode. That's it. Tech Guy Labs. I was working in the lab late one night. TechGuyLabs.com. Interesting. Oh, gosh, there's so much to talk about every week. I like to start the show with just kind of a wander down tech news lane. The stuff that people were talking about this week in technology news. And I'm thinking about all the various topics. Here's one that kind of got me. And in fact, I just saw it this morning. Somebody tweeted it at me. Talented musician, a cellist named Zoe Keating. She posts on YouTube her music. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. Search for her. Z-O-E with an umlaut over the E, Keating, K-E-A-T-I-N-G. And she's been posting. She's got, I think, like 1,000 songs up there on YouTube. And as with a lot of us, I think YouTube is kind of an amazing, miraculous thing. You can post videos on YouTube for anybody to play back almost anywhere in the world. Maybe not China, but almost everywhere in the world. And it costs you nothing. And if you wish, you don't have to, but if you wish, you could turn on monetization. And then they put ads, little banner ads and stuff in there. And you could even make a little money. Probably not a lot of money. There are a few people who do make a lot of money. In fact, some claim, although it's never been proven. I think YouTube keeps a tight lid on this. But it's claimed by some that some are making $1 million a year on YouTube videos. Some less than, fewer than 10 probably, but probably fewer than 5, maybe fewer than 2. Nevertheless, it's an amazing thing. Even if you don't make money on it or you make a few bucks on it, it costs you nothing. But I always warn people that when you are using services like this, Facebook, if you're a business and you use Facebook or YouTube, you got to keep in mind that it isn't really free. It's free under their terms. That, you know, they could pull the plug at any time. That happens sometimes. Usually that doesn't happen. They could. But it's under their terms. They run the service, and they're not giving you something free for free. They're giving you something free because it's worth it to them. In the case of YouTube, of course, advertising, most of the revenue from the ads on your YouTube videos and everybody else's. Most of that goes to YouTube. Hundreds of millions of dollars a year. It's very lucrative. Now, whether that makes up for the bandwidth that they spend, I don't know. May not. They may not be profitable. It's hard to say because they're part of Google. They're part of a much larger thing. But it's theirs, and they get to do what they want. In fact, they don't have to ask permission. They could just, you know. So Zoe Keating, lovely story. She's been able to, you know, her husband is very ill. She's making a living for her family on YouTube, posting videos on there, making a career for herself as a musician. Unfortunately, YouTube has decided to turn on a music service. You probably you may even have it. I have it. YouTube Music Key. If you already pay for Google's All Access Music, you get this. It allows you to watch videos ad-free, queue them up. It's kind of like a music service with video, like Spotify or something with video. And she writes this, she wrote this post on Thursday. She said, the other day, my Google YouTube rep contacted me. They were nice. Took time to explain everything clearly to me, writes Zoe. But the message was firm. I have to decide. I need to sign on to the new YouTube Music Services Agreement, or I will have my YouTube channel blocked. She will have the rug pulled out from under her if she doesn't agree. And the agreement is pretty draconian. She has to make all her songs monetizable. Every song has to have ads on it. She, all her catalog will be included in YouTube Music Key, both free and premium, automatically. She can't say no to that. She has to upload all her music at a certain resolution. And she's locked into this for 5 years. If I don't sign, she says, my YouTube channel will be blocked. She also uses something called Content ID, which goes through other YouTube videos looking for people who are using her music in their videos. She doesn't pull it down. She just, I think she probably monetizes it. She puts ads on it. She doesn't want to do this. But she doesn't want to give in to YouTube's demands. She says, I've played at Google twice. She was at the World Economic Forum in Davos last year. She performed for Bill Clinton at Google Zeitgeist. And she's being forced into a situation that she feels is wrong for her and for her fans. And Google says, so too bad. And you know what? This is the deal we did, isn't it? The deal with the devil. And this is, I bring this up, A, to point out her situation, but more importantly for you to think about if you're a business or you're using a free service like Google or Facebook or Tumblr or Twitter, you don't own what you put there. They own it. You don't control that. They do. And if they decide to put terms on it, you have no choice but to leave or to agree to the terms. And that's the Sophie's choice that Zoe Keating has to face. And this is, I think, tragic for her, but a lesson for us. It's why I've always said you should have your own website that you own that nobody can shut down. Because otherwise you're at their mercy. She's not doing it the Google-approved way. And she doesn't want to. She knows better. In fact, I think she's right. I think that this is not appropriate. Her husband's very sick, which is sad, and I think in some ways that adds to the pressure on her. This is how she makes a living at this point. So it's just it's a cautionary tale for all of us, and I hope that that Google is listening and will kind of change their tune, not just for Zoe Keating, but for all the musicians who have used YouTube, who have created a community around their YouTube channel. And for the rest of us, I think we've got to find another way or an alternative way. Maybe don't give up on YouTube. We post all of our videos of this show. I do a 25 different shows on the internet each week on my podcast network. And we certainly post on YouTube, but it isn't the only place. In fact, it's not the most important place we post. And we make sure that we have videos hosted on a space we own that we control. and audio so that people can download it. Even if YouTube decides, oh, yeah, we're going to change the rules here. 8888-ASK-LEO. What do you think? Let's talk about that. I'll help you with your tech problems, too. After all, that's what I'm here for. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the number. Heather Hammond, the phone ranger. Good to see you, Heather.
Good to see you.
How are you? We're going to work a double shift today. You know that, right?
What?
What? We're going to record a second show after the first show for airing later.
Mm-hmm.
So you're prepared to sit around a little
longer?
All right. So we'll keep taking calls for, I don't know, 5 hours. So we're
plenty
just
gonna, comfortable.
I am just going to sit here, answer calls. You know, my friend Jason Snell, who was a former editor-in-chief of Macworld Magazine, and has his own podcast network now at sixcolors.com. Really great. But he posted on Twitter, he put up on YouTube a video of him appearing with me 15 years ago on the TV show we did together at the time called Call for Help. And it's only a little depressing because he has not aged at all, and I've aged considerably from those days on Call for Help. But it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to see it. He's doing a tip on how to do print. That guy on the right, that's me.
Oh, wow.
And the guy on the left, Jason Snell, looks exactly the same. He's doing a tip on how to do print preview in Internet Explorer on the Mac. That'll give you some idea of how long ago that was. Anyway, kind of fun.
Sorry you missed the boat. Aging is the new aging. Have you heard?
I'm trying. I'm trying. So what Heather and I do here, so Heather answers the phones, and then she says hello. And she, you know, she prepares you for your appearance, your moment of fame. And then she tells me who to talk to, and I pick up the phone and I talk to you, and then that's how the show goes. So you've been doing that. You have a full board,
it looks
like.
Sometimes I actually say, is this the party to whom I am speaking?
No.
Do you go, now I just aged myself.
It's the party to whom I'm speaking.
Can we do stage lighting? Don in San Diego has a question.
You know
about
me.
It.
I'll talk about anything, whether I know anything about it or not. Don in which line number is that here?
He's six.
Oh yeah, way down at six. Thank you. Thanks, Heather. Hi, Don. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Good morning, Leo. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. How are you?
I'm doing well in beautiful San Diego this morning.
I'm jealous. I bet it's gorgeous.
It is absolutely not a cloud in the sky. 79 degrees.
Wow.
Yeah. It's very, very nice. Hey, I've got a question. I'm getting interested in stage lighting, basically DMX controlling.
Yeah.
I find very little information, basically, on how do you use a DMX controller to talk to DMX devices. So, case in point, for Christmas, I got a stage laser. It's a four-color stage laser made by Katha. It's a CTL-DCM. And it's capable of doing lots of different things. I can put it in auto mode, and it will listen to music or whatever and play different things, but it seems to repeat the same things over and over again. And I picked up a controller also.
Yeah, you need a controller. So DMX is a system for controlling lights. Well, you know, as long as there have been stage lights, there have been some way to control them. And as soon as we got into the kind of electronic era, just like you control audio, faders and on-off switches and different colors and so forth. But we've gotten now digital, and so the DMX is a digital system that can send information to DMX-enabled lighting and do all sorts of stuff. We use DMX lights in the studio. It's the only reason I know what I just said. It's because after that, I'm lost. Most theatrical productions, most television studios all are using DMX because it's a very sophisticated way of doing it and very flexible because it's essentially a computer network.
Right.
Which is great. Now, there are some there are some caveats. You're not supposed to do it with any sort of pyrotechnics,
right?
Because errors can occur, and you don't want a flashpot to go off when you're standing over it,
right?
There are also limits into how far it can go. Although it could go pretty far. So my suggestion is there's some really good videos on YouTube of all places. We were talking about YouTube on how to use DMX. You already have a controller, so I'm sure there's information in there.
Yeah, but what I don't understand is how you set the controller up. This is some of my issues. Like the laser, it says it's a 7-channel DMX. And what I don't understand are, what are these 7 channels? So to me, if I'm addressing from the DMX controller to the laser, that should be 1 channel. What do these other 6 channels do?
Well, it may not be something your laser is capable of, although the fact that they put it on your laser means it probably is. But the reason there's 7 channels, there's 3 color channels, red, green, and blue.
Okay.
There's an intensity channel, so how bright it is, and there's for each red, green, and blue. So let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then I guess is the 7th on or off? I guess that's probably what it is. So,
okay.
So, but that doesn't mean, I mean, your laser may not have red, green, and blue elements or a way of controlling that color. So it may be that all 7 are not needed. You may only need on, off, and intensity, 2 of the 7 pins. But if I'm thinking because it has, well, that's the standard. So, you know, we have, for instance, in the studio quite a few RGB lights. And I have a little mini DMX controller right next to me that lets me change the color of the lighting behind me. Because it's red, green, and blue, I can make it any color, and then intensity, which how bright each color is.
So is each slider considered a channel then on the controller?
Well, it depends on the controller, but yeah, normally, yeah.
Okay.
There may be, sometimes one pot will do double duty because there'll be a option switch above it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's pretty
straightforward if you think of it. Now, you know, if you think of it as red, green, blue, you know, and then intensity of each, and then on, off, that kind of makes sense, right? That's 7.
Yeah. But now what if I want to push out the animation? So this thing has some animation already built into the laser, but let's say I want to push out some other types of animation. Is that done via the controller? Or do I have to go with, like, an ILDA box or something like that?
You're just trying to show me up now. John, do you know offhand? We have a gaffer who does this. A gaffer is a great old term for a lighting guy. Okay. It actually comes from the old English for an old guy. An old man is a gaffer. You see him come in with his little pipe. You're a gaffer? No? No. All right. If there's any gaffers, is there a gaffer in the house? No, so I'm not sure, but I would guess the programming, we have programming on our lights, and usually a board will have an additional way, right?
Each channel, you
assign a number to the channel, and then you can have patterns programmed in, but that will come from the board. Now, if you're saying it, you can, because it's a laser, it can draw things.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure where that programming comes from. That's where we need a lighting guru. But you know what? There are people right now listening to this show on our great mothership in Los Angeles, the KFI. There are probably 10,000 gaffers listening right now who are yelling at the radio. So I'm going to give those gaffers the chance to call in. But as I said, it's so weird that that's not well documented in the manual for your board and your light. That should be.
Well, it's a Chinese translation, you know.
It's in the Chinese English.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's always fun. I should do a segment of the show with dramatic readings of poorly translated product manuals. I'll tell you what, somebody will come up with this. If you can call the show, 8888-ASK-LEO, or put a comment on the question on our website, techguylabs.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You're Mr. Scott Wilkinson. He's such a shrinking violet.
Yeah, well, you know.
Our home theater guru. He is the editor-in-chief of the AVS Forum, which is an amazing site for people who want to know more or share their knowledge. In fact, that'd be a good place to go, I bet you, for information on DMX boards and DMX controllers. I bet there's stuff there at avsforum.com. He also hosts a show on my network, which is Fabu, called Home Theater Geeks. And that is, what do you do that, Thursday, Friday?
Thursdays, 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. Pacific time, 5:30 to 6:30 Eastern time. Just had a two-parter on CES with a panel of journalists who were there, and it was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, including my old friend Robert Herron.
That's right.
From Tech TV. Mm-hmm. So that's, you can watch live at twit.tv, that's our website, or you can download any show. All the shows are available. And you can even subscribe at twit.tv/HTG. It's free. The subscription just means that you get it automatically every week. which is a good idea if you like this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
So we are a week away from the Super Bowl.
The Super Bowl.
And even if you're not into the NFL, this is one of the – it's interesting. One of the last big, highly rated TV shows is the Super Bowl.
Yep. It's one of the reasons why live TV continues to survive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in fact, at CES, we learned some news about some services that are going to be providing live TV over the internet streaming so that you don't have to have a cable subscription or a satellite subscription. And among the channels that are likely to be offered is ESPN. Now, whether or not you get the Super Bowl on ESPN is questionable because I think Fox or CBS, I don't know who, has kind of exclusive rights to it. So it may still...
I want to say NBC, but I can't remember.
Maybe it's NBC. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not a sports
guy. Who cares?
Guy.
I don't care. See how much we don't care? I am. I'll be watching it, but do I know what network it's on? No.
No, and it doesn't matter because you'll find it. In any event, I myself, I'll be watching the Puppy Bowl.
Can't you do both, hilarious. Or is that at the same time?
Well, you could. You could. And in fact, that's one reason you might want to get a 4K TV. You know, everybody asks me this time of year, what TV should I get for the Super Bowl?
This is probably the briskest selling week in televisions.
I think it is. Yeah. I think it is. And of course, we've got these 4K or UHD TVs, as they're called, which give you four times the resolution of HD. And so people are going, well, should I get a 4K TV? Well, generally I say no, because there are still some aspects of this whole infrastructure that aren't settled yet, plus the fact that it's not being broadcast. And I just read recently that there will be something like six 4K cameras at the Super Bowl shooting the action, but they're not going to be used for broadcasting the game. They're going to be used for being able to zoom in on certain plays and certain action and still have that zoomed in part be 1080p, be high definition.
So they could zoom in four times.
And still have high definition.
Have high def.
Exactly.
That's too bad. I wish they would at least record it so that, you know, maybe NFL Films is. NFL Films has always kind of done, in the past, film recording of this stuff.
Well, right. And they might very well record it in 4K. Yeah. But I wonder how
this might be the last year that we don't have 4K.
It might be. Yeah. Of course, last year they said that too. So.
One of these days. And they don't do 3D Super Bowl.
No, they don't.
What?
3D is, no.
Come on. 3D is the next big thing. Come on.
Wrong.
You know what I want to see? High frame rate UHD of sports would be spectacular.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
That would be worth watching because
UHD is what we kind of colloquially call 4K, although they're not the same. But it's four times the resolution of high.
Four times the number of pixels on the screen. Correct.
So it's much clearer, and high frame rate would be motion would be better.
Right. It's called temporal resolution. The number of pixels is called spatial resolution. But if you have fast pans and balls flying through the air, you're going to still have a lot of blur. And so
there's no point in buying a 4K or a high frame rate TV for this year because you won't see it. But I wouldn't be surprised if next year. The problem is that any TV you buy this week won't be this new standard, this UHD standard.
Well, that's correct.
Is that
right? That's correct. It'll have the number of pixels we're talking about, but it will not have high dynamic range, wide color gamut, high frame rate. It won't have any of that stuff.
But what if it's next year and then I could buy next? Should I wait if I can?
Yeah, I would.
Okay,
if
you can't, then what should you get?
I would get an HD. I would get a standard high definition.
And what do you like?
If you're on a budget, I really like Vizio, the M series, M as in Mary. If you have more money than that, I like Samsung and Sony in particular. Panasonic's flagship is very good.
Of how much the M series are very affordable. You can get a 60-inch, which is a nice size TV for $1,000 in the M series.
Yep.
70-inch is about $1,600.
Yep. And I certainly would get the largest you can fit and afford into your room, because the Super Bowl, you're probably going to have people over. It's right. going to be a party, you know, and a bigger screen is going to be a good thing.
Amazon has the 49-inch, which is a little small, but still better than nothing, for $520. I mean, it's amazing how the prices. And you think it's these amazing. Are good looking? These are acceptable?
Absolutely. Okay. The 2014 Vizios are all what are called full array backlit, full array with local dimming. Backlit sets, and they really, really look good. I have a 60-inch in my house right now, and I'm enjoying it tremendously.
Yeah.
So
these are LED backlit LCDs.
Correct. Okay. Correct. And since they're so affordable, I think that's the way to go right now until all of this UHD right. stuff gets settled.
Then you give it to the kids and you get the good TV for yourself.
Exactly. Next year or whatever. Right. Exactly. Uh-huh. Then there's the issue of broadcasting. You know, we don't have UHD broadcasting at all. That's a standard that's going to be called ATSC 3.0. ATSC stands for Advanced Television Systems Committee, which created HD broadcasting. And so terrestrial UHD or 4K broadcasting is coming up, but it's not going to be for another year or two. We don't have any satellite 4K. Well, we sort of do. Dish announced at CES that they're going to download 4K content and be able to play it on their new client device called the 4K Joey.
Mm.
So that's the first pay TV service that we know of that's going to have actual 4K content. But there's no 4K cable. It's going to come first by streaming. And, you know, we still don't have all of the pieces in place for that yet. So it's premature, in my opinion.
Bottom lining it. Don't buy a 4K TV for the Super Bowl this year. There's no point.
Nope. No point
to
it.
If you have to buy, if you can't hold on for another year or two, then buy an inexpensive but decent quality Vizio M series.
Yep.
Then you can enjoy that TV to this year. Enjoy. You know,
yep.
One of the reasons.
That's exactly right.
Even though they do stream the Super Bowl and stuff and there's ways to watch it, I remember a couple of years in a row I was on a cruise during the Super Bowl and we watched kind of some sort of international version.
Mm.
But it's no good. It's no good. They take the commercials out.
That's why I watch the Super Bowl.
I love the football, but man, the commercials are great. The best
that's
commercials
right.
of the year.
That's right. That's right. And if they take them out, then, you know, I'm going to go to the Puppy Bowl. Thank you very much.
Scott Wilkinson, avsforum.com, and also on Home Theater Geeks, twit.tv/HTG. Thanks for joining us. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Scott, I shall let you have the floor. You want to stick around for the top of the hour, too? Oops, I potted you off. Go ahead.
Well, Rusty Bones is asking a great question. What happened to the Vizio's reference series? And that is a really, really good question that a lot of people are unhappy about because it hasn't shown up yet. They said it would be before the end of the year, and it wasn't. That was last year. So we don't know. We don't know what happened to it. It was easily the best TV that we saw at CES 2014, and it had high dynamic range. It had all kinds of great stuff that we wanted to see very badly, but so far it has not materialized, and a lot of people are now calling it vaporware and being pretty unhappy about it. So that's a problem. I agree with you, Rusty Bones. I wish they had brought it out. They did bring out a 4K TV called the P series, but it does not have high dynamic range. It does not have wide color gamut, at least not a standardized one. So, you know, I can't necessarily recommend it. As I said on the show, it's just premature. Now, I say that with a grain of salt because, you know, early adopters are really important, and I don't want to discourage them because without them, there would be no innovation. So I'm kind of caught between a rock and a hard place here. For the general consumer, I have to say it's not time yet to buy UHD or 4K. It really isn't. But for the early adopter who buys new TVs every couple of years anyway, well, there's two schools of thought on that. One is if you buy a new TV every couple of years anyway, then sure, go get a 4K and get another one in a couple of years. But if you don't have all kinds of extra money lying around, then I say what I said on the show and what Leo said, which is buy an HD TV now, inexpensive one, for a couple of years and use that for a couple of years until the standards for UHD have been nailed down and implemented in TVs and content. This is the whole point of the UHD Alliance. And on my show, the Home Theater Geek Show, this coming Thursday, my guest is going to be Joe Kane talking about that very thing, because he's been advocating as much as I have and more about getting these other elements nailed down, not only in the TVs, but in the content as well. That's the critical factor. And the UHD Alliance is our first glimpse at a hope of maybe this happening before too very long, because there are some studios signed up, there are some TV manufacturers signed up, there are some distributors signed up, and if they can all get on the same page with high dynamic range, wide color gamut, bit depth, all that kind of stuff, then we're going to start seeing something really, really special. As it is now, 4K TVs are simply high definition TVs with four times as many pixels. That's all they are. And there isn't any content for them specifically to speak of. So, Jazz G5, 4K 3D Puppy Bowl. That's what I want. Absolutely. Man, I love the Puppy Bowl. I think it's great. Mechman Laptop says he has a P-Series, a Vizio P-Series, and it looks good. And I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does. It absolutely. However... it's simply an HD TV with more pixels, and that's really all it is. Now, it's a good looking HD TV. Most of the reports I've heard have been very good, so that's great. And it's a Vizio, so it's probably relatively affordable. I haven't looked at the prices lately, but that's you know, a good thing. Let's see.
Don't answer another one.
Okay.
Thank you, Scott. Stick around.
I'm happy to stick around.
All righty. Thanks. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo, that's the number, 888-827-5536, toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada outside that area. Well, you can Skype us. That's cool, man. We get a lot of Skype calls. It's kind of fun. I'm all over the world. You do need to know the number, though. You'll use Skype out to reach 888-827-5536. I didn't talk, and I will talk probably next hour, about Microsoft's announcements this week. They had a big event on Wednesday releasing or talking about the new Windows 10 and some really interesting stuff. Really exciting. And you know me. I think I've been pretty outspokenly against going Windows unless you have to. But this may we'll see. Proof's in the pudding, but... Microsoft is definitely angling to reassert itself in the new world. It's exciting. We'll talk about that a little later on in the show. Meanwhile, back to the phones we go. Dan on the line, Woodland Hills, California. Hi, Dan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Just this morning, I received a notification for updating Java. But for the very first time, a window popped up warning me about this latest update that it may not work with the current operating system, and I'm using XP. Now, I was wondering whether I should go with the with this update or not.
Boy, that is a real challenging question, isn't it? Now, on the one hand, of course, Microsoft has abandoned you. Windows XP, starting last April...
Right.
Was no longer getting support or updates, so there are security issues. Once they stopped working on XP, other companies will likely follow suit. Google has said, we're going to continue to update Chrome until later 2015. So what Oracle, which runs Java, first of all, I would say, don't use Java unless you know you need to.
Okay.
Do you know you need Java?
I do.
Okay. There are a couple of reasons you might. You might need Java for something like Minecraft or some specialty software.
Right.
It's becoming less and less important, but there are still some reasons you need Java. If you do have Java, Java's fine to use on the desktop, but I would absolutely disable Java in your browser. You know, one of the problems you already have is you can't get an up-to-date version of Internet Explorer. It's too dangerous to use the Internet Explorer 8, which is the latest version you can put on there.
Well, I'm not using that. I'm using Chrome.
Chrome is kept up to date. Good. And Chrome, by default, disables Java. But just in case, there are very few reasons you'd want Java on the web, and that is the most dangerous use of Java.
I see.
So updating Java becomes less important if you don't use it on the web. If you're just using it for Minecraft, it's probably not important at all. The updates are security updates, but they're only a security issue if you are on the web. You see, really, there are only a few ways somebody can attack you. They have to attack you if they can't get to your machine physically, and I presume you don't have hackers living upstairs. If they can't get to your machine physically, they have to get to you through the network, through the internet. So the stuff that goes on the internet, your browser, Flash, your operating system, those things are vulnerable, must be patched. Now, Java 8, they say, Oracle says, will continue to work on Windows XP. I would not go to a later version of Java, like 9, but when they do push out security patches, I would do them.
Okay.
Does that make sense? What version of Java are you trying to install? Probably 8. It's still 8, isn't it?
You know, I'm not sure what exactly was.
They don't say specifically it's not going to work. They say it might not work.
Exactly, right.
Yeah. Well, it's not too hard to go backwards. Java's unlike a lot of things that Java can be. You can roll it back.
And how would I do that if it causes
you just download an older version.
Okay.
Which Oracle does make available for this reason.
I see.
And install it on top of it.
Okay.
So I think it's probably okay to say yes. You certainly – here's what I – my kind of blanket recommendation would be stick with Java 8.
Okay.
So when it says this is Java 9, say no. But do apply security patches. Oracle says we will continue to send out security patches. Those are very important. And then most importantly, disable Java in your browser, because that's the only reason you need the security patches.
Right.
Unless you doubt, you know, okay, if you go to creepyminecraft.com and download a hacker version of Minecraft, then you could be vulnerable.
Right.
Right. The key is a guy's got to get something on your system and run it, and he has to do it through the internet. But disabling the browser plugin is a very good way to kind of protect yourself. The other thing to do with Windows XP, and I hope you're doing this, and by the way, if you do this, I think you're probably safe to continue to use XP, is to not use it as an administrator.
Right. I've taken your advice on that before.
All right. Then I think, you know, using Chrome, because that's being kept up to date, don't use IE anymore.
Exactly.
Don't run as administrator, run as a limited user. By doing that, you're keeping bad guys at bay anyway. And then update, if they say there's a problem with the update, don't do it, but definitely always, as long as there are security patches, apply those.
Okay.
Okay?
Sounds good. Thank you, Leo.
You're very welcome. In the browser, there's settings for all browsers about Java. Now, don't confuse Java with JavaScript. Very important. You're going to need JavaScript. Most websites, including my own, use a lot of JavaScript. Unfortunately, that's the way it is. But JavaScript is not as risky as Java. And here's why. When you're running Java, you're allowing somebody out there through the browser, somebody out there to run a program on your system. That should ring a alarm warning, right? There's a red flag. Somebody out there on the internet can run a program on your system. That's Java. Now, Java was designed from day one to be secure in that situation. They sandbox and so forth. But apparently, as time's gone by, the security features of Java have not proven effective. JavaScript is a little bit different. JavaScript is a scripting language that sometimes is run on the server, the web server you're visiting, sometimes is run by your browser. But a modern browser, like using the latest Chrome, will, I think, almost certainly protect you from any risks in JavaScript. And JavaScript, the thing that runs JavaScript, your browser, is being updated regularly. That's why it's dangerous to use a browser that's not being updated. So don't confuse JavaScript with Java. I do recommend, if you're using Chrome on XP, keep JavaScript enabled. Otherwise, your web browsing experience will be very, very limited. But absolutely disable Java. Chrome does that by default. And so does on the Macintosh, so does Safari, so that when you get to a page that for some reason needs Java, and this, let's say they're old card games. You know, if you ever played Solitaire at Yahoo, you know, Yahoo Solitaire or one of the Yahoo games, those used Java. If you go there, it'll say, oh, I need Java to run. Your browser will pop up a request saying, Java is disabled. Would you like me to enable it for this site only? That's okay, as long as you trust that site. Now, there are ways to run JavaScript a little more securely. There's an extension called NoScript, which turns JavaScript off but allows you to turn it on selectively. The browsers don't do this, unfortunately. The browser, it's either all on or all off. Better if, just like with Java, you could say, okay, I want to use Java, or I want to use JavaScript only on this site because I trust it. Only on with Microsoft.com and Apple.com and TechGuyLabs.com. Those sites, I trust them. I'll use JavaScript with them, but nowhere else. But there isn't a way to do that without an additional plugin. And it gets pretty complicated. I don't worry about JavaScript so much. Most of the JavaScript issues are about privacy, not about security. On the other hand, Java has some real security issues. So does Flash. That's why, if possible, we recommend not installing Flash. We recommend not installing Java if you can avoid it. If you have to install it, then you have to take additional precautions. 8888 asks, we'll put this in the show notes at techguylabs.com. Next hour, I'm going to talk a little bit about what Microsoft announced. Huge announcements. Windows 10, Microsoft's listening. Wow. And in fact, this coming week, you should be able to, if you want, download Windows 10. I'll talk about why you might want to do that, why you probably don't, and how you would go about doing that, and what to look for. It's surprisingly reliable. Arizona Wheels in our chat room is saying, should I get rid of the Oracle Java program that I have? You should uninstall Java if you don't use it, yeah. It's not a bad idea. You know, for instance, a Macintosh doesn't come with Java or Flash installed. That's the right way to be. Because then you don't install it unless you know you need it, because the website said, hey, I need it. Then you can make the decision, an informed decision, I hope by now, of whether to install it. 8888 Ask Leo. We'll take a break. Come back after the news at the top of the hour with more of your calls. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. All right, Scotty, my friend.
Aye.
It's all yours for 6 minutes or something.
Thank you. I am getting a little bit of bleed. I'm not sure where that's coming from.
I'll be very quiet now. See.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm getting something, but it's okay. I can ignore it.
I don't hear it here, so it must be in your system.
Oh, okay,
it
must be on my end. Yeah, okay. By the way, my last podcast, I actually did get back to high def and widescreen and everything cool.
Yeah, you're looking good right now. I don't know why.
Okay, well, I don't know either. Charter, who knows? Charter certainly has been a problem, and then last week, all of a sudden, it wasn't. I mean, Russell and I have been working on this for weeks. Anyway, so hey, chat room, glad to be here with you guys again. We've been having a little conversation in here about future proofing and how they shoot TV shows now and so on. You know, a lot of TV shows, I don't know how many are still being shot on film. I can't believe that many. I haven't done any research on this lately. I bet a lot of them are being shot digitally now. But it certainly not being shot with high dynamic range or wide color gamut because those things aren't standardized. And we don't have cameras that will – well, we do have cameras that will capture them. But, you know, how do they know when they're shooting the movie or the show, the television show, what to shoot in? You know, should it be for a peak wide of 1,000 nits, which is what we saw at CES this year? That's probably going to be the first standard. But it's not finalized by any means. In fact, Joe Kane told me, he said, yeah, they made a big announcement about UHD Alliance and all these companies coming together. There hasn't been a single meeting of the UHD Alliance yet. There might have been this week or this past week, the first one. So we're still a long ways off from having a standard for high dynamic range, wide color gamut, bit depth, and so on that that we're not recording right now. So all the archive TV shows and everything, David Bix made a great point about, hey, we're talking syndication money down the line. And he's right. I mean, we're still watching I Love Lucy, for heaven's sakes. So, you know, the shows that are being shot now, what's going to happen to them in 2, 5, 10, 15, 20 years that when they don't have that stuff? It's going to look pretty dull and dim and poor on the sets of 5 years from now. But, you know, it is what it is. We've also been talking about LG OLEDs. And they sure looked good at CES. And the 55-inch, I think, is still around $3,000, the current one. And, you know, that's a fair deal, I think. It's curved, very slight curve. And so, and it's only 55 inches, and it's 1080p, which to me is not a big deal. But a lot of people it is. They want, oh, I want my 4K. Well, sure, if you get a 77-inch LG OLED, it will be 4K. But as sure as heck isn't going to be $3,000. Now, they did say that they have brought down the price dramatically over the last year, and they have. So they said, oh, and our 2015 models are going to be competitively priced. Okay, that's fine. Still, a 77-inch OLED, 4K OLED, is not going to be cheap. That is not going to be cheap. I'm sorry to say, but it isn't. So let's see here. Oh, Dave in Texas has a good question. If a television show was shot on film, what's the maximum resolution you could convert it to without starting to use interpolation? Couldn't go to 4K? Yes, you can go to 4K. If you shoot on film, the resolution is limited only by the size of the little photochemical grains that are light sensitive, that are what make film possible. And those things are tiny. I've heard it said that they offer the equivalent of 6 to 8K resolution, spatial resolution. The problem is those grains are of random size and shape. They're all very tiny, but they're not digital pixels. They're not perfectly square or rectangular or whatever shape they are. They're these little, you know, like dust grains is what they are. And so there is no very clear, definitive definition of what's the maximum resolution. 4K is certainly possible, and most film material today is archived in 4K. It's scanned using a scanner device. Each frame of the film is scanned at 4K and saved at 4K, at least. I think Lawrence of Arabia, when they redid that, it was at 8K. And so that is, I think that's more or less the limit of what you can do with film. You can't go any farther than that with film. Let's see. David Bick says, right now, all the big syndicated shows were shot in HD or shot on film and remastered. Whoever shot Seinfeld and Friends was a genius, he says, to use film instead of videotape, especially on shows that really didn't have a filmic look to them. True enough. Absolutely. And it up until only very recently, virtually all TV shows were shot on film. And then you can, as we were talking about, you can go and scan them into digital and save them as digital, which is what they do now. And now nowadays, I think more TV shows are shot digitally than I don't mean on videotape. I mean digitally to memory, you know, to a memory card. It's immediately translated into digital and stored digitally on a memory card of some sort. Battlecam asks, what about AV receivers supporting HDCP 2.2 and HDMI 2.0? Did I see any of that? Well, there was very little in the way of AV receivers at CES. That's not the show for AV receivers. However, I did learn something really important about HDMI 2.0 and HDCP 2.2. I had been under the impression that HDMI 2.0 basically has two bit rates that it can use, 10.2 gigabits per second, which is the same as HDMI 1.4, and 18 gigabits per second, which is required for these higher elements of UHD. And I was under the impression that HDMI 2.0 with HDCP 2.2, if they were combined together in the same unit, the bandwidth was limited to 10.2 gigabits per second because it's a hardware thing. They have to bake that into the chips. But I learned at CES that that's not true. That, well, it is true, but that there are, in fact, products on the market now that have 18 gigabit per second HDMI bandwidth with HDCP 2.2. And I found that very interesting. I thought that that had not come out on the market yet, but it has, which makes it even harder for those of us who follow the industry and who want to buy something. I absolutely recommend that you get a product with HDCP 2.2, copy protection, very important for UHD content, and high bandwidth, 18 gigabits. But manufacturers don't want to reveal what their bandwidth is. And most reps that I talk to don't even know. So it's even harder now to determine whether a product is going to have that capability or not. And I'm going to try and dig as deep as I can to find out as much as I can about it. But it's really hard.
Thank you, Scotty. HTG, twit.tv/HTG. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time for computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, and all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. 8888 Ask Leo. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada if you want to call in and talk about tech. So, you know, you've heard me. I don't think it's a surprise to anybody. You've heard me kind of diss Windows for a long time. My rule of thumb has been for some years, Windows for business, Macintosh for home. That's changed, actually, over the last few years as we've seen the cloud become more important. Internet storage, internet computation. Now, with Google's Chromebooks and iPads, I think for a lot of people, the complexity of a full-blown operating system is unneeded. Why would you need a Mac or a Windows machine when you can do everything you want on an iPad or a Chromebook? They're simpler, they're more secure, less prone to viruses, less prone to just breaking down because of the complexity. Nevertheless, there are plenty of people who still want a full computer. And for those people, there are really three choices. There's Linux. I shouldn't leave that out, although very few people choose it. It is an option. It's an open source free operating system, which is really kind of interesting in so many ways. And you also already use it in all likelihood. You certainly use it when you surf the web. Most web servers run on Linux. And if you use an Android device of any kind, you're using Linux. But for desktop, most people think of Windows or Mac. And Windows has easily been the dominant operating system for more than 30 years, primarily because why? I don't know why. It's been used in business. People use it in business, and then they say when they get home, oh, we need a computer. Let's get one like the one I use at work. Must be good, or they wouldn't have it at work. When Macintosh came out in 1984, it had a significant uphill climb and is still a single-digit market share. Windows is being used by 1.5 billion, not million, billion people worldwide. Many of them, as like our last caller, using an old version of Windows, Windows XP, but still, in fact, that's almost half of all the users are still using XP. Microsoft kind of ran up against a buzzsaw, though, with its latest version of Windows, Windows 8. Windows 7 was a very traditional version of Windows. Desktop, start menu, applications. It was just, if you'd used XP, if you'd used Vista 7, pretty much the same. But Microsoft got worried. They looked at how people are using computers differently these days, and we really are. They saw tablet sales explode since Apple introduced the iPad just 5 years ago. They also saw people starting to use internet services like Google Drive, Google Calendar, Yahoo Mail. And they realized that a lot of what people used a computer, a desktop or laptop computer for, they didn't really need a desktop or laptop computer. A smaller, less complicated device would work fine. So Microsoft, which had been very strong with cloud services and business, started to move those cloud services over to consumers. Products like OneDrive actually, I would argue, work better the consumer version works better than the business version. And they also started to look at how we could re-engineer Windows to make it easier to use and more friendly to touch devices. They saw, and remember, this is, they probably started thinking about this right when the iPad came out in 2010. That's, you know, you start designing the next version of Windows when the current version came out. You start working on the next one. They don't waste time. It's like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. They're never done. So they're starting to work on Windows 8, maybe 10 years ago. They realized touch is going to be very important. They already are starting to do a version of Windows Phone that is very touch-centric. They say, we ought to do Windows. We ought to make Windows work well on tablets. And they made kind of a strange beast in Windows 8. It was a version of Windows that had many of the features of Windows 7 still, but also merged together with touch features like as you would have on a tablet. They even released a tablet of their own, the Surface, to go with it. And the business world just turned their back on it. They said, we don't want to retrain people. We don't use tablets. We have people sitting at desktop computers doing Excel spreadsheets and PowerPoint presentations, doing email. We're not going to retrain them. We're not buying Windows 8, period. Consumers also looked at Windows 8 and got a little bit confused. Many of them bought Windows 8 because it came with their new PC and were frustrated and livid. They said, well, I don't get this charms bar. I don't understand it. Why are there two versions of Internet Explorer that work differently? Why are there two versions of the control panel? I don't understand. And sales for Windows 8 were very slow. In fact, even to this day, Windows 8 is less used than Windows XP or Windows 7. So it's very frustrating for Microsoft, very frustrating for users. But Microsoft didn't give up. They said, all right, we got to fix this. And they've decided to skip Windows 9, skip right past it, to emphasize that Windows 10 is something new, something different. Windows 10, first of all, currently there are three versions of Windows 8. There's Windows 8 for your phone. There's Windows 8 for Surface RT tablets, or Windows RT tablets, which is kind of a weird in between. And then there's Windows 8 Professional. And programs written for one usually don't run on the other. In fact, very rarely run on the other. It's very confusing for consumers. There's different stores. And then let's not forget Xbox, which is a whole different operating system. So Microsoft decided to unify them all. There will be one version, Windows 10. No matter what device you use, you'll be running Windows 10. And they did something, they announced something on Wednesday that was a bit of a shock for a company that made almost all of its money selling Windows. Remember, they didn't make hardware until recently. Almost all of its money came from selling copies of its operating system. They announced it would be free for everyone. Free for you to upgrade if you're running Windows 7 or Windows 8. Free for you to upgrade if you're running Windows Phone. In fact, they're even going to put it on Xbox eventually. It's going to be Windows 10 everywhere. And they'll have one Windows 10 store for all those different devices. They've brought back a lot of the desktop interface. So people who wanted something that worked like Windows 7 still will have it. But the minute you move, and they call this continuum, the minute you move into a tablet-like environment, Windows will know. You don't have to know. Windows will know. Say, oh, I see you don't have a keyboard and mouse anymore. Should I be more touch-focused? Now, of course, they have done a surprising thing, which is release copies of the technical preview to anybody who wants to. And if you want to become a Windows insider and get the latest version of Windows 10, you can. I don't recommend it unless you know what you're doing. Don't put it on your production device. But it's pretty, you know, it won't be out till the fall, but it's pretty in pretty good shape now. If you Google Windows Insider program, you'll find the page. You can sign up. And you can even download the latest version of Windows 10. The new consumer version just came out. And they're going to try it with a lot of people. Now, they say it's for experts, and I would agree if you know what you're doing. But millions of people will get to try this before they start pushing it out. And this fall, when it comes out, it'll come out free for everybody who's using 7 or 8. Their idea is to get everybody onto Windows 10 as soon as possible, as quickly as possible, so that people will write software for it. And I feel like Microsoft has listened to the complaints, listened to people who've said this is confusing, and they've really tried to respond. And I frankly think this is important because we don't want a world that is dominated by Google and Apple and Facebook and Amazon. We need a strong Microsoft. So I'm very excited by this. They also announced an entirely new user interface, the HoloLens. We'll talk about that a little later on. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Ba 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 ba. Isn't it kind of? It is kind of Windows OS 10, isn't it? No. It's Windows. It's very much Windows. It's more like Windows 7 than 8. And I think it's the right thing to do. I'm actually pretty excited by what they're up to. If you have a old device that you're ready to upgrade, can I point you to a partner of ours? Our advertiser on the podcast today is Gazelle. GAZELLE.com. Gazelle will buy your old iPhone, Samsung Galaxy phone, iPad, or MacBook. They'll even buy your old Surface tablets. If you got something hot, you got the new hotness for the holidays, don't just throw that old device in the drawer. Trading in your old device after the holidays, like getting another gift. You've got cash in your pocket. Gazelle is great, too, because they'll give you a 30-day quote. So you have 30 days to decide. They'll pay the postage on the device, so you just pile it into a box. And I would suggest getting every device in all the drawers. And then you can get cash, a PayPal credit, or an Amazon gift card for the value of your device. In fact, for the Amazon gift card, they'll even bump it up 5%. They give great prices. They'll wipe it if you forget to, and the shipping is free. It is a very easy way to get rid of your old electronics. It's also a very easy way to replace a lost or stolen phone because they now have Gazelle-certified pre-owned products. This is like their little Gazelle store. Only the best stuff traded into Gazelle goes here. And devices are always put through a rigorous 30-point inspection to make sure they're not only fully functional but in great shape. And they back it by a 30-day risk-free return policy. There are two different conditions. You can get certified like new, which is, well, like new. Or, I like this, certified good. You'll save money, and it might show some gentle signs of wear, kind of like the old device that you lost. But it gives you a great price. Looking for an iPhone 5 from $219? That is a great deal. An iPad 2 from $199? Check it out. Gazelle.com. Whether you're buying or selling, Gazelle's the place to go to get rid of the old and ring in the new. Get paid in cash when you sell it. Get a great device when you buy it. G-A-Z-E-L-L-E, gazelle.com. We thank them so much for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. I just want to be free, man. 8888 Ask Leo. Well, that's what Windows 10 will be. Free, man. Fascinating move from Microsoft. I mean, this is how they made profits for years, was selling Windows. I guess they found another way. Julian on the line from Santa Barbara. You're next. Hi, Julian. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Leo, hi, can you hear me?
I hear you great, Julian. Thanks for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. I had a real simple question, and advertising works. I went and bought a workforce printer with Precision Core.
Right on.
I didn't think I needed to, and I went to the store and looked, and I couldn't resist.
Good man.
I had a real simple question. What do you think about using third-party ink?
I think it's a false economy, but I'd leave it up to you. I'll give you the pros and cons, and you can decide. I've always bought Epson cartridges. By the way, Epson's an advertiser. So let's get that out of the way. So disclaimer here. But I do use workforce printers. I don't know off the top of my head if Epson does what other printer companies do on the workforce printers, if they replace the head when you replace the ink cartridge. I suspect not, because it's a multiple cartridge printer. But that would be one reason. On some inkjet printers, when you replace the ink, you also replace the print head. And so that's an important thing to do, especially these less expensive printers. It's one of the reasons print cartridges are so expensive. You're actually replacing a part that does wear out fast, and I think that's a good way to do it. I don't believe they do that on the workforce. I also don't – I think the ink is fairly affordable on the workforce. What's the difference in third-party ink?
Oh, it's half the price.
All right. I would try it and see if you're happy with the result. Now,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, I there's no compelling argument against it. I mean, the companies like Epson will say, well, if you don't use our ink, you could jam your printer. You could mess it up. It could stop working right. And I do have to say PrecisionCore is kind of special because they are the smallest inkjet droplets ever. These are nanoliters, billionths of a liter. They're tiny droplets. That's why PrecisionCore is such a high resolution output and it's so fast, is they've done some really advanced stuff. This came down from their industrial grade printing. And it's possible that third party ink is just not formulated well enough to use with a PrecisionCore. So you do run the risk of clogging your heads.
And I'd heard what you'd said about all the tiny drops, and that was exactly why I was asking the question. I've used third-party ink with various printers for years with no problem.
Yeah, and I haven't, so I can't say for sure. I mean, I think it's fine. You can't really believe the companies when they say don't do this, because this is a big part of their profit is selling expensive ink. On the other hand, you are running a risk. So I just don't have enough data points to know whether. The PrecisionCore just came out. I mean, it's literally a month or two old. So I just don't know. I always use Epson ink. I don't go through ink fast enough to really have to worry about it. But if you go through a lot of ink, I guess saving 50% would be a big deal.
You've persuaded me. I'll buy Epson ink.
Yeah, I just, I would wait and see. Read up on it and remember that. Both the third-party ink people and Epson have a vested interest in you buying their stuff. So, look for reviews and so forth. The other issue that you should be aware of, and I don't know if Epson's doing this or not, some of the companies are using now chips in their cartridges to prevent exactly this, to force you to use company cartridges. I don't know if Epson's doing that. I don't think they are. But there is copy protection on some of these printers, which means you can't use third-party ink. But if somebody's selling third-party ink, I would figure they've probably got around that.
Yeah, you can. I don't want to mention the name. There's one of the well-known, one of the leading.
Yeah, Staples and other people's. Yeah.
Yeah, I've used it for a long time, and they're offering it already for the.
Give it a try. It's not going to break it. I think it's highly unlikely to break it. It might clog it, and then you'd need to, unclog the head. But I can't imagine it would make that much difference.
So, how difficult is it to unclog the heads?
Then you got to go through that whole process of head cleaning, which uses a ton of ink. This is a good question. I just avoid the issue by buying company ink for all the printers, whatever brand I use. The other thing I don't recommend, and you'll see people selling hypodermic needles with ink, injecting ink back into the old cartridge. I do not recommend that. It's messy. It's a pain in the butt. And I frankly don't think it'll do a good job for you.
I mean, I tried that a long time ago.
Yeah.
I'm with you. It's
most people do it once.
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't think that using remanufactured cartridges or third-party cartridges, I don't think necessarily is bad. It seems such a waste to, throw those big plastic cartridges out. One good thing about Epson is they don't have little tiny cartridges anymore. They use big cartridges. So, I just don't know. I don't have enough information.
And can I stick in a quick side question for
sure.
Scott Wilkinson? When you talked to him this afternoon, what does he think about using a 50-inch 4K television as a monitor for a desktop? Because I just love the idea.
Yeah, I love the idea of the real estate. I get asked this a lot, and I don't recommend it because TVs are not as high res as your computer. Now, if you're sitting 10 feet away from it, no problem. But don't put a 50-inch screen on your desk. Sit arm's length away from it. It will not look good. Text will not look good. It won't look good. It's not as high res as you think.
But hang on. I actually did the numbers, and I have a 30-inch monitor now. And if I went to a 50-inch with 4K, I actually get more dots per inch on the bigger screen.
All right. I mean, okay. That might work. Don't do a 1080p, but yeah, if you did a 4K 50-inch, yeah, that might work. Remember that TV screens are not as high quality as computer screens. They don't, because they're not designed, they're designed for being used at a greater distance.
Mm.
So backlighting and so forth is different. But you know what? Try it. Let me know. Get back to me.
I've
never used a 4K TV. I've only, I don't know.
I'm going to follow half your advice. I'm going to buy Epson Inc.
Okay.
And I'm going to try the 4K TV.
All right. And then spend the money you've lost on a 4K TV. It makes perfect sense to me. Now let me ask this. Is it a 50-inch 4K TV? It's less than a 37-inch or 30-inch 4K monitor?
Well, I don't care about it. Oh, I see. It's something I use all day, every day. I'm not too concerned about a few hundred dollars on the price.
Yeah. I feel like with a TV, you're buying stuff also that you'll never use, a tuner, smart TV capabilities,
sure,
and all that stuff. You can get very good 4K monitors now for not much money. Here's a couple of things to look at. Refresh rate.
Oh.
A TV refresh rate does not need to be as fast as a monitor. You want 60 hertz refresh. Okay.
Yes.
That's very important.
Yep.
A television often is just capable of 30 hertz at 4K. So you won't find that out. And then make sure that you can drive it appropriately. Usually you can now. Most computers have HDMI out, so that's not such a big deal. And then somebody's telling me it's not DPI that matters, it's pixel pitch. So look at your pixel pitch. I don't know what the difference is. 88, I guess that's how close together the pixels are. 8888, ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Response time. I think response time on TV. Well, I don't know. That's a good question. Get a monitor. I don't know why you would. Johnny Jet is here. He fly that big old jet airliner right in our hearts here at the Tech Guy Labs. Hello, Johnny.
Hello. I'm in snowy Connecticut. I was just speaking at the New York Times travel show, and I took the train out this morning.
What do you talk about when you speak at a travel show?
Well, yesterday I was at the trade show, so I was talking about the power of influence. But usually I talk about travel tips, travel deals, how to get the best ones, how to travel like a rock star on the budget.
I bet a lot of travel writers, though, especially the old school ones, are very interested in how you do what you do, because you have made yourself a force and a living by using social media, by using the web. Right. I mean, it's really remarkable what you've done, Johnny, and you've turned yourself into one of the most famous, well-known, and successful travel writers of all, and it's primarily using social media.
For sure. I mean, fortunately, I started at the right time. I remember when I started, people used to laugh at me, literally, all the travel writers, the PR people. And then all of a sudden, I could see its shift in 2004.
Yeah.
I started it as a hobby. It was just for fun. It was my love of travel. I was afraid to travel. I got addicted to it. And then I really wanted to share it with everyone else and show it how you can do it. It was never to make money.
Well, that's one way to start. I mean, if you don't feel the pressure to make money, you can experiment. Most travel writers in that era thought, oh, well, you got to be associated with a magazine or a newspaper to have a shot.
Although I used to go to these conferences and TripAdvisor would be at a booth, the founder of TripAdvisor, who's now a multi-billionaire. And I'm like, oh, my God, we started at the same time. I could be a billionaire.
No.
But you know what? I've had a very good life. I get to travel and have spent time with my friends and family.
I know so many of the people I came up with are billionaires now. And I just say, well... There, but for the grace of God, go I. Many of the people I came up with are on the streets, too. So, it can go either way. It really could.
Well, even if I was a billionaire, I'd still be doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, you got to follow your path.
Helping me out.
You got to just
follow
your path, you know.
But my love is travel and to share it with people and try and get people out and see the world. Because as corny as it sounds, the world would be a much better place if people traveled.
I agree.
And understood each other.
I agree.
There's good and bad people everywhere.
Using the internet to travel better.
Yep.
Give us some tips here.
Well, this past week, actually, might have been last week now, that Google Translate updated their app.
No. love it.
So now this app is the number one app you should have while you travel internationally, because it can translate between 90 languages, 90. And then we've talked about WordLens before, which
they bought
an app that they bought.
Yeah.
And now you can translate 7 different languages, and you don't even have to be online, but you can just hold your phone up, your camera up on your phone, and it will translate whatever sign, menu, and you don't even have to be on
the
internet connection.
They even duplicate the typeface. So you see a sign, you're in Poland, that says, and you point your phone at it, and you look through the screen of your phone, and in the same font, the same color, it looks like the same sign, it says, you know, this way to the bullfights. It's like, wow. Well, you wouldn't see that in Poland, but you get the idea. You go, wow, it's translating it in real time. So that's one feature. But I think even more important is the conversational translation. Tell us how that works.
Yeah, so I'm on my phone. I can go into Google Translate. I just had it set up, and now it's gone. But you go into the app. It's free, by the way, on both Android and iOS. So I can say, you know, I'm gonna. Here's my phone. Actually, I'm on the radio, so people can't even see. So you just hit the microphone,
He's
and I'll say,
his phone up to the radio.
How do I say I love you in Russian? And then it will repeat it back.
But even better, let's say you're in France. Let's hear it Russian.
Okay.
That's good. You translate it into Spanish. Instead, how do I love you in Russian in Spanish?
Well, you know what? I had the Spanish button.
So let me explain this, because Johnny's doing a terrible job. So, the really cool thing that they've added, and by the way, it never had this feature on iOS. It does now, as well as on Android, is if you go into a restaurant and you don't speak French, they don't speak English, you can say into the phone, can you tell me what your specials are today? And then you hold it automatically, you tilt the phone, switches to him. He answers in French. He hears you speaking in French because it translated your voice into a spoken word. And then he says in French, and then you turn the phone again. It says in English, you're stupid American. I do not need. And you go, I understand everything you're saying. Je comprends tout. And he goes, oh. And then you can have a conversation back and forth. It is science fiction. It's amazing. It is what Douglas Adams in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy called the Babel Fish. It literally detects what language you're speaking in, what language the other person's speaking in, and does real-time translation. You say a sentence, it translates it. He says a sentence, it translates it back to you. You can have a conversation. It's a little bit slower, but not much. With somebody, neither of you speak the same language, and it works in French, German. You know, as you said, there are many, many languages for the simple translation stuff, but this conversational stuff is a little bit more limited. Something like 10 languages.
Seven languages.
But it's incredible. It's Star Trek, folks. It's incredible.
What I don't understand is how do they make their money on that? Because it's free.
Google.
And I don't see any advertising on there.
Google doesn't need to make money. Don't worry your pretty little head about that. Just use it.
People always wonder how I make money. I wonder how Google makes money on this app.
Here's a real answer to that, is Google makes plenty of money in advertising. They may someday put advertising, but they don't worry about it because they make so much money and they have so many bright engineers. One thing Google is doing is working very hard on translation in general, both written and speech. They have some of the best people in the world working at Google. The Guy Cohen, who runs the division, is the guy. And I think that their attitude is the more you use the internet, the more money we'll make. So we just want you to use, and that includes foreign language translation and so forth. So,
but now people cannot use the excuse that, you know, I'm afraid to travel to these foreign countries because I don't speak the language.
Just try it. The hard thing to do is find somebody who speaks a foreign language.
Actually, my buddy Sasha, who was just here, he's Spanish. So he was the one who was playing with my phone and set it to Spanish.
Let's get Sasha in here. You can have a conversation. It's mind-blowing. When it works, it's mind-blowing. I got to tell you, it's incredible.
It really is.
Now, your website, by the way, Johnny has his own website, johnnyjet.com, where you'll find all this stuff. And I think this is your web. What is this, question and answer thing? Travel website of the week. Where do I end up if I dig straight down? What is this?
This was just a real fun one that someone sent me, but I thought it would be fun to put on. So you go to ubasics.com/dighole, And it work, and then you can just and it has two maps. You can point to wherever you are, and it will tell you exactly where you are. So growing up, I grew up here in Connecticut.
We always said China, but that's not necessarily true, is it?
It's not true at all. I thought it was. I would have ended up in the middle of the Indian Ocean.
Oh, according to this. So don't do that.
Yes.
So I'm gonna move the map to point to where we are in Northern California. And then see where I would end up. Where am I going to end up? Yes, the middle of an ocean.
Yeah, so, and you can zoom in and out, obviously.
I don't even know what ocean that is. Oh, yeah, Indian. I'm just off.
Indian
Yeah, that's not so good. So yeah, most of us, we'd end up in the ocean.
In America, yeah. So anyway, I thought that was a little fun one. If we have time, I got more stuff if you
want. I got a minute. Go ahead. That's terrible. All right, so, I would end up in the ocean. Well, that's that. I'm not digging straight down. Terrible. Okay, what else? One more.
So how about...
What?
Did he say 10 seconds? I'm sorry.
I think 10 seconds means no time at all.
Okay, sorry.
Save it for next week. That's why we love you. JohnnyJet.com. He's full of it. Lots of travel tips. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. JohnnyJet.com. Follow him on Twitter. He's great. Sorry, too. This is a good one, though. I like it. I've always wondered. Wonder no more in the middle of the Indian Ocean. That's ridiculous. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We tried in the break to use this Google Translate with Johnny Jett has a friend who's from Barcelona. I think that's the problem. He was probably speaking Catalan because we couldn't get the. But I want to do. We got to find somebody who speaks. French or German or Spanish. I'm going to take it to Germany with me. We're going to Germany in the summer and see, because I don't speak German. And Hungary. I don't know if it speaks Hungarian. What a great idea. Google Translate's free. iOS and Android. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. Back to the phones. Daryl, Palm Desert, California. You're next. Hi, Daryl.
Yes, good morning, Leo. You guys need to try to have a little fun once in a while.
Boy, it's such hard work here.
Yeah, I could tell during the break.
Somebody, I do not have a job. I do not have a job, but I love my job.
I heard you tell somebody earlier you need to follow what you want to do.
Yeah,
sure.
Follow your love. And if I just feel very lucky, but yes.
My daughter bought recently a brand new Dell laptop at a office store. The first thing that happened was once in a while she stays at our house, and she came back to here, and she started just powering it up, and it asked her for her name.
Yeah.
She got one letter typed in, and it said, hi, her name. She has been here before. She has used the Wi-Fi. However, that's not the most bizarre thing.
That's normal, by the way. It just because she's used the computer before, right?
Not this particular computer.
She had never used the computer ever before.
No, she just opened it up out of the box.
Okay. So she typed the first letter of her name. What's the first letter of her name?
G.
G?
Mm-hmm.
And she types it and says, hi, Gloria?
Well, hi. It said, hi, Gina.
Hi, Gina.
Yep.
Huh. Okay, yeah. Continue on. That would be normal if she'd used it before, but the fact that this was like she opened it and came out of the box and it was doing that.
The only thing she would have used here before, she has been on our Wi-Fi.
Well, no, she's used the computer before, though.
No, she was brand new.
It was sealed in the box. This is like a magic trick. Okay, did it say, is your card the Eight of Spades? Did it do something like that?
Wait until the next one. She downloads Google Chrome. And as soon as she gets it downloaded, the tabs across the top are a mirror image of her sister's desktop 10 miles away. It's got her kids' school district tab there. It's got her husband's college online school tab there.
She has logged into this computer before she sat down and said,
no.
Gee.
No. She bought it at a box store.
Well, then her sister did. So this is normal, by the way, on Windows nowadays. You log in through your Microsoft account, and then it remembers all your settings and so forth. That's normal.
But it's not her.
But what's very, well, maybe, but that's why I think her sister must. You sure her sister hasn't used it?
No, it's brand new, Leo. It's out of the box. No, she bought it and brought it to our house.
So, okay, so the first, very first screen she sees is what?
Now you mean?
No, when she first turned it on. I'm trying to figure out where she entered G and it said, hi, Gina.
It was asking her to set up the computer where you have to put in your name and just the
some,
original
okay.
setup.
And she's not been with it to her sister's house or her sister hasn't been anywhere near it?
No, no. The next thing she does, she opens up Facebook and there's her sister's Facebook account with her password. Logged her right on.
Okay.
They weren't here at the same time.
All right. But there's no magic. Computers are deterministic. This is not, there's no magical system going on. Somebody logged in once. And it probably your sister, without your knowledge, has used this computer before. How would the big box store know her?
She bought it from OfficeMax or one of those places.
Well, it's just magic in that case. I don't understand how it could possibly happen. Carl in Ephrata, is that right? Ephrata, Pennsylvania. Hi, Carl.
Hi, it's Ephrata, Pennsylvania.
Ephrata.
In the heart of Pennsylvania, Deutsch country.
Yeah.
Ich kann Deutsch sprechen. Do you need someone who can German speak?
Not an Irish accent. That's not going to help at all.
No, this is Pennsylvania. Irish, do you?
But you sound like you're Irish.
With a name like Carl Schott?
I don't have my phone in front of me, but this would be fun. I think you would. So it's nice to talk to you, Carl. Thank you for calling.
My pleasure. I think Sasha would really make out well if he had some shoe fly pie and scrapple on his menu.
You know, can I get a soft pretzel dipped in butter?
You'd want to try it in mustard instead.
Mustard, okay.
All right. I'm calling today because rather delayed. Over the Christmas holidays, I got an email from Facebook.
Yeah.
Indicating, and it's extremely wordy, indicating they're changing their policies. And I'm listening in on the ham radio. I'm hearing things to the translations indicating to the effect that if I were to ask, let's say you and I are friends on Facebook, and I'd say, hey, Leo, would you like my photography page? They're going to charge me for it. Things like that. And I have no idea what they're trying to do with Facebook.
It's fake.
I'm sorry?
It's fake.
Okay, so it's a bunch of baloney.
It's not from Facebook.
Okay, so just neglect it and get over it.
Yep.
Alrighty.
Thanks for the call, Carl.
Hey,
does this mean I don't get the Scrapple?
Scrapple? Yeah, you want some Scrapple?
No. I know what Scrapple is. You can't fool me with Scrapple.
Scrapple goes good with eggs and potatoes and some good pumperdine.
What's pumperdine? Is that a kind of bread?
Yeah, it's twice as good as pumpernickel.
It's a pumperdine.
Yeah. We even have.
I fell right for it. I fell for it. Oh my gosh.
See ya.
Did you set him up to do that, Heather? I fell for it. Pumperdine. I love pumpernickel. Hey, thanks for the call, Carl. I appreciate it. Okay, was that two prank calls in a row? Okay, I'm just checking. So I did hang up on the previous caller, not because I feel like he was misleading anything, but it's not possible. So no computer magically knows your sister's name and Facebook login. It doesn't come from the factory that way. Unfortunately, her sister logged into that computer and didn't tell her. And that's the only way that could happen. One of the things that does happen with Microsoft Windows these days, you don't have to, but it really strongly encourages you to use your Microsoft account. And if you have a Microsoft account, in many cases, your Microsoft account contains things like your Facebook. It's connected to your Facebook. It's connected to your Twitter. It's connected to your email. It may well be connected to your browser, in which case it would automatically synchronize browser tabs and all of that. So all of that is actually normal in Windows 8. It's designed to do that way. It makes it great to set up a new computer when you've got Windows 8. You log into your Microsoft account, and it's pre-populated with all that stuff. You don't have to set it up separately. There's no way it does it automatically. Now, it is possible that whoever you bought it from at the time of purchase, he said it was a Dell computer purchase. Dell does not do this, but the big box store, maybe they asked for some credentials. Maybe her sister bought it for her, and they asked for credentials when they bought it, and they set it up for her. That's very possible. There's no way, though, a sealed-in-the-box laptop computer, it's not magic, knows your login, your sister's login, or any of that stuff. So at some point, maybe the big box store somewhere got your sister's, not hers, not Gina's, but her sister's credentials and set it up for her. Easy enough to start over again, by the way. I want to dispel any notions that this is somehow magic. It couldn't be. It isn't. Computers are not magic. It's a deterministic system. There's no magic in it. So presume somehow your sister's credentials were supplied to either the big box store or she logged into it herself and isn't telling you. Secondly, you can wipe it. You can start all over. And I would recommend that so that you get the out-of-the-box experience as it was intended, where it says, who are you? What's your name? Let's fill this in. So it's in the recovery options on Windows 8. You can wipe it and make it completely clean and fresh. And, you know, since you don't know who or how this happened, it wouldn't be a bad idea to do that. But there's no magic hacker in the sky who's piping that down into your computer. It's not anything you should worry about. And Facebook is not changing its terms to take over all your pictures. And that is, common spam. Just ignore it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, hey, hey. Good to see you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. We're talking about our last call, but one. Trying to figure it out. Heather and I are trying to figure it out. I figured it out. It's Munchausen's by proxy. You ever hear of that? It's a very odd psychiatric syndrome. Munchausen's disease isn't a disease. It's somebody who creates an illness in themselves so that they can go to the doctor and say, I'm ill, and get attention. And then really worse is Munchausen's by proxy, where they create an illness in a child or a sibling and then get the attention by bringing the child or sibling to the doctor. Do you think that he's called back, and I really apologize for not having an answer for you, but I it's not what you've described is impossible. Now, if it's Google Chrome, that's different than Windows setup. So, but initially he was saying, well, when we opened the computer and we went to Windows setup, my daughter typed G and it knew her name was Gina. And it got worse from there because then when we got into Chrome, it already was logged into her sister's Facebook and had her sister's tabs. So it may be just a description that's puzzling. Maybe we don't have all the information accurately. Windows doesn't know your daughter's name. Chrome doesn't know your daughter's sister's information unless you log in. I'm wondering if after Gina did puzzling, how to know my name, did then provide Windows credentials, then that could have pre-populated the rest of the machine, including Chrome, with settings. I think somehow the sister's information was provided at some point. Don't know how. John in L.A., Leo Laporte. I love this mystery, though. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Got a bit of a problem with iOS on a Windows. I'm sorry, not Windows. iPhone 4. I'm running iOS 7, latest edition, on an iPhone 4. As is my wife and both my parents. And in the last 3 or 4 months, we keep having issues with iMessaging shutting itself off and then not allowing us to log back into it. And we only find out about this when we don't receive a series of text messages, because they're being sent to iMessage, and iMessage is turned off on our phones.
How annoying is that, huh?
It's pretty annoying.
Yeah. It may be. I'm not familiar with this problem. You're all on different accounts, right?
All on different accounts, but all on AT&T Wireless.
Yeah, I don't think it's
running iPhone 4 and all running iOS 7.
Yeah, I mean, iPhone 4 is pretty old. You can't go to I wouldn't recommend going to iOS 8, although that might be some of the issue. I'm not familiar with this problem. I haven't heard of this happening before. Chat room, have you heard of this at all? Make sure. Let's see. Here's an interesting article from November of last year, Macworld UK. Recover missing text, shut down iMessage if you move to... I don't know about that. It's an old platform. The iPhone 4 is several generations old. It's three or four years old. It was the 4, then the 4S, then the 5, then the 5S. Now we're at the 6. And I don't think you should have to buy a new phone every 5 years, but it is a 5-year-old phone. You can't put the latest version of the operating system on it. I just feel like there's something having to do with that. I don't know other than that. And have you asked Apple, called Apple?
We haven't called Apple. My wife went so far as to check online to see if she could get support. And, of course, once she entered in her, credentials and information, it tells her, well, you're not under warranty, so therefore there will be no free support.
You should be able to call Apple, though, and say, here's what's happening. And they should give you – they may say – we won't support you. I think they'll give you basic support. I would call them and say that's a very odd thing to do. You're saying the iMessage. Can you log back into messages?
Well, that's the tricky part. When you go in to see, someone calls up and says, "Hey, I've been text messaging you all day. You aren't responding."
Yeah, horrible.
You say, "I haven't been getting them." So you go and you look. Nope, no messages. On further, just kind of probing around, you get into general settings and go into messages and find out message has been shut off on the unit.
Yeah,
but
I haven't heard that Apple is not supporting messages on older hardware, but maybe they are disabling it. You should still be able to get text messages no matter what.
Right, and that's where the trick comes is when they try to send you the iMessage on their iPhone.
Yeah.
If they just hit send and then walk away, they won't notice that 30 seconds later it pops up and says message undelivered.
Ah.
Or in some cases, what I've seen is it doesn't even do that. It goes through as though the message delivered,
right,
as I understand it, because the iMessage servers up at Apple have received the message and they've sent it out.
Right.
But if iMessage is off on your phone, you don't receive the message because you're not...
Yeah, the Apple has had nonstop problems with this messages system. The idea is that if everybody is on iOS, an iOS device, then we can just use the internet and our own servers, Apple's own servers, to pass the message along. It'll be like WhatsApp. It'll just pass along a message.
Right.
If everybody isn't using iOS, if, for instance, one of you is using Android, it will use the standard AT&T text messaging system, SMS, to send the message, using message units if you have to pay for SMSs. Most people now have unlimited SMS messaging, so this has become less of an issue. There's been a lot of problems with this, though. For instance, if you go from an iPhone to an Android phone, people don't know you have. They'll send you messages. Apple will stupidly continue to send messages via messages, but not SMS, and you won't ever get them. And this is a real mess. Apple's only recently fixed it by allowing you to deregister your phone number with iMessage. That would be one way to do this, which is to, in effect, say on these phones, these iPhone 4s on iOS 7, go in and deregister that phone number with messages across the board. That way, only text messages will come through.
I tried that, Leo, and what I ended up with was the Apple deregister tool.
Yeah.
Said, your phone number is not registered with this Apple.
Ah, that's interesting.
So iMessage doesn't even think we're on it.
Well, that would explain why it's not working. I don't think this is AT&T, but it might be worth a call to AT&T. Unlike Apple, at least you're still a customer of AT&T's, and they still want to keep you. So it might be worth a call because they might have heard about this. But in theory, this would fix the problem because anybody who sends a message to you from Apple's messaging system will say, oh, no, they're not on messages, and route it through SMS, which is what you want. On the sender's iPhone, by the way, not your iPhone, but on the sender's iPhone, Apple will just block it, say, can't send messages And it does it transparently. That way you'll get everything, and you'll have to make sure you don't use messages to send messages, but use SMS to send messages from now on. But I guess it can't deregister it if you're not logged in. Have you tried re-logging in, reattaching it? Can you do that?
It gives a message that says there was an error logging in.
Yeah, it sounds like Apple has at their end deregistered you. So you probably do need to call Apple and say, what the heck? That's something wrong. And, you know, I'm not surprised this has been a broken system since the day they introduced it. It's very disappointing. I think maybe if you could get to iOS 8, it would be better. But I don't know. The chat room has some ideas and thoughts. Maybe we can get those and incorporate those into our website, techguylabs.com. Look in the comments section, and I'll keep watching the chat room to see if they have a solution. Sounds like you've done the things correct. It's worth a call to AT&T. Perhaps they have heard of something like this and know a fix. And I think Apple owes you a fix on this. I really do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So Tinker Toy Tech says it's happened from his losing his Wi-Fi. WP788 says I did something the other day and it reset my iMessages. Make sure there are two addresses under settings, iMessages, send, receive. Our Tech Guy podcast, as always, brought to you by the good folks at Prosper.com. This is Silicon Valley at its best. Take something that we have been using for years and make it better using the internet. Prosper.com. Prosper is something they call peer-to-peer lending, very hot right now. The idea is you connect people who have money to lend with people who need to borrow. And you kind of eliminate the idea of a big bank loan and all that crazy paperwork. You just make it easy. So this is, you know, why go borrow money? There are not that many places you go anymore, really, to get money. You can go to family or friends, but that's not going to end well. You could borrow it on a credit card, but with those interest rates, you'd have to be nuts. It's like going to a loan shark. You could go to a loan shark. Don't recommend it. You like your kneecaps? I'd stay away. Or you can, you know, put on a suit and tie and go in hat in hand to a bank and get a traditional loan. But now you don't have to. You can get a low fixed rate loan from Prosper.com for up to $35,000 in as few as 5 days, and use the money for just about anything. Pay off high rate credit cards, fix up your house, put it into your business. I love this idea. Prosper connects people with money to those who want to borrow. Or invest, I guess, if you know what's happening is people are actually investing by putting money in Prosper.com, and then somebody borrows it and you make money, you make the interest. So why rack up more debt on your credit cards? Pay them off with Prosper. Check your rate instantly without affecting your good credit. Go to Prosper.com/twit. Prosper.com/twit. And for a limited time, Prosper is offering our viewers a $50 prepaid card from Visa when you get a loan. Wow, that's nice. Go to prosper.com/twit. Fill out that form. By the way, you're going to get a rate that will not affect your good credit, which is nice. You can just see what your rate would be instantly. prosper.com/twit. And when you get the loan up to $35,000 in just 5 days, you'll get a $50 Visa prepaid card as our way of saying thank you. prosper.com/twit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Unfortunately, our last call has resulted in a bunch of people complaining about messages. we're all complaining about some or other feature of messages. But somebody did suggest, and if the caller is still listening, I'm sorry, I hope you are, that you do a network settings reset on your iPhone. So to do that, you go to General. Go to your settings, then to General. And reset, and inside the reset, there's a variety of resets. One of them is just simply reset network settings. Try that. And then you might need to re-log in. I'm not sure. You might need to re-log in to messages. That's just frustrating. I understand. Sorry. Jay in Placerville, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Leo. I have a stuck CD-ROM drive on a 1999 Dell Optiplex.
You can't get that drive to open up?
No, I can't.
Uh-oh.
I've tried hitting the button on the right hand of the front panel. I've tried turning the dial on the left hand to the left, to the right, to the center. I've gone to my computer and opened up the CD-ROM drive, and I've hit eject, and it grinds, and it whines.
Oh,
but it
all right.
Does not.
We're going to have to perform surgery. Can you sterilize yourself?
I am waiting to the new computer is waiting for the software on right.
So there is, if you look closely at the front of the CD-ROM player, there's a little tiny hole.
Yes.
And there's that hole is that's the manual eject method.
Ah.
It's the emergency release button. So you'll need a paperclip. And
I
you
have.
Stick it in there and you push it, and it might take some effort because it's physically pushing the drawer out.
Okay. Thank you, Lee.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Thank you.
Worst case, you can always disassemble it. Sometimes what happens is...
I want to say a good word about Dell. This has held up wonderfully electronically. It's just the mechanics that are shot.
I'm impressed from 1999. That's awesome.
Yes. I endorse Dell.
Yeah. No, in fact, I just bought a new Dell.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that one. I just got their new, in fact, this maybe be a good one for you. Their new laptop, they showed this at CES. It's the first laptop. Lenovo's doing one too, I think, with the newest Intel fourth generation processors. I'm sorry, fifth gen. It's fifth, isn't it? Fifth generation processors, the so-called Broadwell processors, which are reputedly going to give us amazing battery life. But one thing they've been able to do with this new Dell is almost eliminate the bezels on the screen. They call it the infinity screen. You know, like the infinity pool? You can't see the edge of the pool. It just looks like it goes forever. It's an infinity screen. The edges, the bezels, which hold the screen in place, are very tiny. I mean, you still have to have something there. But they're very, very thin, and that gives them the capability of putting a 13-inch screen in a computer that's really the size of an 11-inch laptop. So I'll have a review for you of that in about a couple of weeks. Not next week, the week after. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the number. Usually if a CD's gotten stuck, there's a physical reason for it. If it won't eject, then maybe that CD is flipped up and it's blocking the drawer. Worse, if you had a paper label on it. Sometimes those paper labels come unglued and jammed, and that can be bad too. Try the clippy. If the clip doesn't work, the paper clip doesn't work, you might have to disassemble and kind of open it up to get into whatever it is and see what's blocking the drawer from coming out. Tom in Lake Havasu, Arizona. Hi, Tom. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing?
I am well. I went to London to see the London Bridge, and they told me it's in Lake Havasu.
Yeah, you missed it. It's just down the street.
Jiminy
here.
Christmas. Who knew? Everybody.
Yeah, it was funny. In the middle of the desert.
What can I do for you?
Hey, listen. My Nikon D40 got stolen when I was on vacation. My father would have been stolen any place, but I left it out in the open.
Oh, but that's a sinking feeling, isn't it, when you come back and it's gone? Ugh.
You know, there wasn't much on it at the time, and I was going to cop an attitude, and I thought, you know what, it served me well. It was a good friend.
There you go. Maybe it'll serve the next guy well.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Down there, I was in Belize. I don't know if they're going to be able to find the parts they didn't steal.
I love my new camera, but I can't charge it. You know, a used D40 is about $100.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about picking one up, but at the same time, for the past couple of years, we were thinking about maybe making
time.
A change. I was just, you know, I've called like B&H and Ditti, or is it D&H? I can't remember. And you get to talking to some of these guys, and it gets pretty lofty pretty quick. Let me tell you how I use the camera. I've always used it on automatic mode. The features, of course, I love the quality of the photographs. But what I really like the most is that we can do editing and enlarging and not lose anything.
Right.
I think you could make a billboard out of the quality of some of those prints. So I was wondering, I would like to get something that has the same capabilities that's maybe smaller, you know, in the same
way. Yeah, the time has come to get a new camera, and I think actually this is a great opportunity. That D40, as I remember, is 6 megapixels.
Yeah, I can't remember.
So let me tell you, most camera phones have more megapixels now.
Well, but I don't get the quality, for example, out of my latest...
The glass! You know, the glass is what makes that a great camera. I don't know what size sensor. Was it an APS C sensor? I don't remember.
I was out of a big box store, put in the battery, and away we went. Yeah. Never even thought about it anymore.
But what, did you ever change lenses?
You know, we did get a telephoto, but we just kind of stuck with the basic default lens that came with it. And it just did everything for us. It really did. We've got it. We've got 6,000 photographs that are just memories. And I want
to keep that going. So happy days. You know, that that camera, it was a little superannuated anyway. It's time maybe to move on to something a little more modern and with even better image quality, frankly.
That's what I'm looking
for. Yeah. Do you still have the Nikon lenses or did you lose those as well?
I lost the lens. We've got the one telephoto.
But you don't care about that particularly?
Not particularly. You know, I might sell it off on eBay or I might do like you suggested. I noticed on eBay, you can buy a lot of the D40s, but most of them, they've got pictures, photographs of them on there without the lenses, and the opening is open, and I'm thinking, well, that's sitting around collecting.
I wouldn't buy a D40 right now. I mean, it really is pretty old.
Yeah.
We're talking now the current Nikon in that kind of startup first camera, first DSLR, is 24 megapixels, four times the resolution. Mm-hmm. And that is so everything you loved about those 6 megapixels will be even better now.
Really? Which one is that?
The 7100 is excellent, but I'm thinking you want smaller and lighter. I'm thinking since you don't really use the alternate lenses, you may even want a kind of prosumer point-and-shoot. So one of the nice things about that D40 is you could get different lenses, but you never used that. You didn't really care for that feature. So
no. No, what we do is we're quite rural most of the time up in Wyoming, and so we're hauling a camera around in a dusty pickup truck or something like that. So basically, we everything gets stashed away, so you take as little as possible.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Yeah,
I'm going to recommend a Sony point and shoot, the RX100. It has a 1-inch sensor, so it's a pretty big. It's a much bigger sensor than a standard point. Actually, hang on. We'll talk some more. We got to take a break. Leo Laporte, VTech guy. Don't go away. One of my favorite subjects, so I'm going to go on and on and on now. Well, not that. Cut it short. Tom in Lake Havasu. He needs a new camera. His old one got stolen. He had a pretty nice Nikon D40. That's a digital SLR. You could change the lenses out. But he wants to save some space, make it a little lighter. Didn't use the interchangeable lens feature, as it turned out. What's your budget? I guess I should ask that, Tom.
Oh, you know, the $500 range would be nice. I just brought up the RX100. It looks like there must be some different ones because it seems like it kicks in around.
Yeah, the original, they're up to the Mark III, but you can get Mark IIs and I think even the original, and they'll be less expensive. Mm-hmm. Great little cameras. I have one. I love it. It's great for low light. It's got a good zoom on it, so you have a good choice of, you know, you can zoom in or go for the low light, wide angle.
Mm-hmm.
The sensor's excellent. It is not interchangeable, and there's one thing you will or may miss, and I don't know how important it is to you. On that Nikon, you can look through the viewfinder and see what's coming out of what's coming into the lens. It's a DSLR. Sony saves space by not having a viewfinder. You'll look at an LCD.
I don't think that's a showstopper, really. It seemed like that other thing kind of got in the way. And then when you were using the flash, you had to cover that anyway.
Yeah. I love this. So point and shoot can, you know, go down to $100 and be kind of a camera that a kid would like. And there are, every pro photographer has one high-end point and shoot that they just carry in their pocket because it's convenient. This is one of those. It's very, very good.
What's Leo? What's the technology called if I want to start? Starting with this one and zero. You know, look around at some of them. What's that technology called?
That's just a basic point and shoot. There's no special technology. The next step up is Micro Four Thirds, bigger sensor, much broader variety of interchangeable lenses. Again, I've eliminated that because that didn't seem like a feature you really wanted. But there's some really great Micro Four Thirds cameras. I really love the Olympus OMD line. They're still compact because they're what we call mirrorless. Your old D40 had a big...
Halfway in between.
Yeah, it's halfway in between. Your D40 had a big prism. That's how you could look through the viewfinder and see out the lens. It was actually just kind of... The light was using a mirror reflected into your eye,
mm-hmm.
but that adds complexity, it adds weight, and it adds size.
Mm-hmm.
So the new mirrorless ones don't do it that way. They actually have a little video camera looking through the lens, and when you put your eye up to the viewfinder, you're actually looking at a video picture of it.
Right. Oh, really?
It's not as good.
Before I didn't get the last part of that. Is that a... interchangeable lenses?
Yes.
That is. So that's the step up. There.
That's the step up. Micro Four Thirds is interchangeable lenses. And then the next step up from that is the one I was mentioning, which I love, which is my Sony A7s.
Yeah.
These are pro grade. This is high level, and you're starting at $2,000 with a lens.
Yeah, that's not.
I think for you, from everything you've told me, I think you'd be very happy. The Mark III does have a viewfinder, but you don't need that viewfinder. So I think a Mark II or just the original RX100.
Okay, before you go, the Micro Four DAC. What was the thing you said after four?
Four thirds, and what that refers to is the size of the sensor.
Okay.
It's a Micro Four Thirds sensor. It's a little bigger than the 1-inch sensor in the Sony.
Yeah.
By the way, most point-and-shoot cameras have a quarter-inch sensor. So the Sony, the size of the sensor has a lot to do with how pleasing those images are to you.
It does, yeah. So that goes, because I heard once there was sort of a megapixel myth because it...
Yeah, it ain't megapixels.
...hand with lots of other things.
Yeah, it ain't
the
just megapixels.
It doesn't mean much.
Big sensor is what really matters.
It is, okay.
Bigger the sensor, the more the camera costs. And the more features it will have. I think the Sony RX100 is a great compromise between the compactness and ease of use of a point-and-shoot, but a larger sensor so you get more pleasing pictures.
Awesome. Hey, listen, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling. You know me. I'll talk about cameras till the cows come home. There are some good choices. The chat room saying the G7X from Canon was excellent. It's the same sensor. It's about $600. Canon does a great job. Sony is now, it's interesting, for a long time, high-end photography, if you eliminate the super high-end, the Leicas, the Hasselblads, the Rolleiflexes, if you go to the high-end digital photography, it was Nikon and Canon, just dominated. But Sony has come on strong. They started by making sensors that people like Nikon and Canon would put in their cameras. And now they not only make the sensors, but they make some of the best cameras out there. And there's been a learning process. But every Sony camera has gotten better and better and better. And at this point, many of the pros I know have moved from Nikon or Canon to the Sonys, particularly the A7s. Just amazing cameras. In fact, there are some. If you go to stevehufffoto.com, Steve's a very avid Leica camera shooter. That's the most expensive cameras out there. Amazing stuff. And even he is starting to say, you know, I think the A7's better. What? That's heresy. Joan in Anaheim, Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Hi.
I have an HP. And I have Windows 7 on the HP.
Nice. Don't change. That's a classic.
I know. That's what I was listening to you.
That's a classic.
But on December 13th, something got onto my computer.
Well, you remember the date.
Well, no. I'm in on uninstall and change programs.
Oh, and you're seeing that it was all December that day, December 13th. Uh-huh. Ah.
So when I it's a slim... Cleaner Plus.
Yeah. So here's what happened. Do you have kids, grandkids, or is it just you on the computer?
Just me.
Probably at some point on that day, you said, I'm going to download a shareware program.
Which I hardly ever do.
I know, but I'm thinking that one day you might have.
Yeah.
And you went to a very respectable site, perhaps something called download.com. which is run by CNET, which is owned by CBS. But unfortunately, lately, like in the last couple of years, download.com has wrapped the downloads of good programs with their own downloader, which installs adware on your system. And that's what you've got there.
Mm.
And while it's not a virus in the sense that they're stealing from you.
Yeah.
They're stealing your time, and they're perhaps making is your homepage or your search different than it used to be?
No.
What are the symptoms? What made you think of this?
Well, it keeps popping up it wants a scan.
Yeah.
And I don't want you to scan. No, I don't want a scan.
Blandishments. It's offering you things. It pops up with offers to do things. And then, by the way, after you scan, it might pop up another message saying, you know, you really ought to buy our $30 program.
Right. And I always say no.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to remove it.
It's fairly harmless. You see it in add remove programs.
Yes.
Or I guess it's called programs and features in Windows 7.
Well, mine is uninstall.
Yeah.
Change a program.
Yeah. So you uninstall, and you've uninstalled it?
I've uninstalled it, and it says preparing to remove, and then all of a sudden it comes up and it says, do you want to allow the following program to update software on this computer? And I answer no, and those two messages go away, and it's still there.
I'd say yes this time.
Oh.
So what I think you're seeing is the Microsoft has something called UAC that pops up whenever you want to modify system files or do anything that could be dangerous.
Uh-huh.
So I think update isn't the right word. I think what you're really doing is removing, but it's asking you, sure you want to do that? And I'd say yes.
Hmm.
And then see what happens.
Okay, I'm gonna try this right now.
And then continue through, because you say December 13th, because you know the date, because you can see. Is there more than one entry at that date?
No.
Okay. So, you know, maybe that you accepted an offer or something. I mean, I'm not sure what happened on that day, but yeah, you don't need that.
Okay, it comes up, do you want to allow the following program to update this?
Yep, software? Click say yes.
And it says program name Slim Cleaner Plus.
Yeah, get rid of that.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
And now you should be okay. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Sorry, I had to take a break there. What's it doing now, Joan?
Well, it says you have to restart to reconfigure.
Yep. Because the reason what this does is this is not some ordinary program. This program starts up when you start up the computer. Uh-huh. It's doing all sorts of stuff. You do want to get rid of that, trust me.
That's what I did.
Yeah, and restart, and it should be gone. And you came across this because you looked in your uninstalls, or?
No, it just automatically pops up when I...
Yeah, that's annoying.
Yeah. I'm in something, and it...
So you're doing exactly the right thing.
When I start the computer, and then it says it wants to do that.
So you're doing exactly the right thing. That message from Microsoft is poorly worded. Because you say, well, no, I'm not updating, I'm uninstalling.
Right.
But that's what they mean.
Oh, okay.
I know, that's not a very good choice of language, is it?
No, it's not. I didn't know that I...
It's because they only have one... They only had room for one message, so they... or something. I don't know. It's just dumb. But by saying okay to that, you're actually giving it permission to uninstall it.
I see. Okay.
What you're really doing is you're updating some system files. You are, in fact, updating them. You're changing them to eliminate the line that says start this thing up.
I see. Well, great.
I'm glad you called, though. You should always be a little cautious.
Yes.
It sounds like you are. Sounds like you are. Good. Now, if you were running as an administrator, which you are, it won't ask for a password. One of the reasons I tell people don't run as administrators is it's too easy to do these things. It's better and safer to run as a limited user or a standard user. Because then you'd get that pop-up and it'd say, wait a minute, you need to be an administrator. What's the administrator password? And you'd have to actually enter the administrator password.
Yeah.
That's a little better.
Okay.
So keep rebooting. Check that remove programs again. Make sure it's gone.
That's what I'm doing right now.
Good. I'll hang on.
And it had to restart, and it's slow on restarting.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, well.
You sure help on a lot of things.
It's my job.
Yes.
I like doing it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo, just so you know, I hung on the line with Joan. She restarted the computer, and yeah, that thing was gone. So that's what update means. It means get rid of, in this case. It's time for the GizWiz, Mad Magazine's maddest writer. Dick DiBartolo is here. Every week he joins us with a gizmo or a gadget that's wild and wacky and sometimes useful. Hi, Dick.
Hey, how you doing?
You feeling good? I could tell you feel you recovered.
I am recovering pretty well, thank
good,
you.
Good. That CES flu was just horrible.
Terrible. Absolutely terrible.
So what do you got for us this week?
Well, you know what? About 10 years ago, you and I talked about something called the Quick Pod. Remember that?
Was it an escape pod?
No, the Quick Pod was now everybody's doing the selfie stick.
Oh.
But 10 years ago, it was the Quick Pod.
That's nothing to be proud of. We invented the selfie stick.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And what is a riot is that Padre found one for $6.30.
He didn't know you'd reviewed this many years ago. In fact, I didn't either. We reviewed it on Before You Buy. I'll be darned. So this is it. But wait a minute. Yeah. I see it for $50 and $60.
Yes. Well, that company is still making it, but now everybody is making it as the selfie stick. But the funny thing is, I'm using mine with a Galaxy Note 4.
Oh, that's a big phone, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I didn't want to spend just $6.30. So I went for the $8
model. Oh, deluxe. The professional edition.
Yes. Well, you know what it is? It turns out the $6.30 thing, when you click buy it, it says you'll receive it in March. Because they're shipping it directly from China. So I kept looking and looking and looking. And then I found it for $2 more, actually $1.90 more on Amazon Prime.
So tell us where to get this and how.
Okay. So it has a name you'll never forget. UFCIT. Okay. So you're looking for the UFCIT.
Oh, this is the one, Padre. This is the one.
Yes, exactly. But I'm just
really
saying.
It's really cheesy. I got to tell you, it is about the strength of an umbrella stick.
Yes.
Right?
But the great thing, Leo, is it includes a Bluetooth shutter button.
That by itself is worth $7 or $8.
You know what? You can pay $30 for that button elsewhere.
Yeah.
So if you're going to use it once in a while, this is going to be fine. But for $8.30, there's the one I bought right there. $8.50.
Did you get the pink one?
It says pink, but it comes in it's red.
Oh, red. Okay, good. It looks like red in the picture. It doesn't look like pink. All right.
I know. Okay. I assumed the picture was right and the copy was wrong, and I was correct. So I got the button. I got the selfie stick. And if you have a point-and-shoot with a regular tripod mount, you don't have to use the little closable spring thing. You can just mount it directly into the bottom of your camera. But for $8.50, you know, I don't take a lot of selfies. Originally, it was when you went to a famous landmark and no one was around, how do you get you in the landmark?
Right. So you put your camera or your phone on this long retractable stick, you hold it in front of you, and it takes a picture, and you can even see on most cameras what it looks like, and then you take the picture of you and the Mount Rushmore behind you.
But that you gotta have a long arm to get you. you need the telephone pole selfie for that.
You know, it's so funny because we mock selfie sticks, but you see them. I bet you live in New York City. I bet you see them everywhere now.
At CES, they have dueling selfie sticks because everybody's trying to shoot over you to get to the product. And
it's really a kind of a measure of the cheapness of television networks. I saw Anderson Cooper with a selfie stick shooting his stand-up for CNN. That's just sad. They couldn't afford a cameraman? Criminally. That explains why most anchors these days, you can't see their right hand. It's out of the shot holding the selfie stick.
That's fascinating. I think you're absolutely right.
But what's weird, as much as I've mocked them, sometimes we call them the wand of Narcissus. Because it's for narcissists.
But as much
as I mocked them, I'm starting to want one. I shouldn't get the $60. I don't have one. I know, you'd think me, of all people, I'd have a selfie stick.
Yeah, well, you know, you have that mirror on a tripod that that follows you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of the same thing.
All it really is extensible stick. The key is how do you get the camera, which is way over there, to take the picture. And that's what's neat about this UFCIT. It has this Bluetooth button and what that bonds with the camera. Do you have to set it up or is it just do it?
Well, you just find, you turn on Bluetooth, you look in the list, and it'll say BT button, something like that. Just click pair with that, and then you put the camera as far away as you want, hit that little button. And it has two buttons. The top button is if you're using an iOS, and the bottom button is if you're using an Android system.
Now,
there
you go. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
This
is a very sad day for me and Dick because... Well, frankly, one of our most esteemed purveyors.
Oh, yes.
Has filed for bankruptcy. Sky Mall.
I think mainly due to you. For two years, we did crap, Leo's crap from Sky Mall.
I bought whatever I could find in the Sky
you
Mall.
You spent thousands of dollars.
And then I stopped, and Sky Mall went under. My fault? So they're not just reorganizing. They want sale of the assets. They want out of the business. They have filed for bankruptcy protection. They were started in 1989. If you've ever flown on a plane, you've seen that catalog in the seat back. They had 137 employees. In fact, their parent company, which is Exhibit, and we've talked about Exhibit Products, is also seeking Chapter 11 in this case, not Chapter 7.
Wow.
So I don't know why. The Sky Mall had a revenue of $33 million in 2013. That was in 2013. They, in the 9 months of ending in September of last year, only half that.
Yeah. So, well, you know, I think part of it is that now you can turn on your electronics as soon as you get on the airplane.
Right. Nobody's looking at these magazines.
Exactly. That used to be the you lived to the Sky Mall catalog during takeoff and landing.
The airlines were paying. I'm sorry. Sky Mall was paying the airlines to get in the seat back. The largest creditors for this bankruptcy are Delta, American, and U.S. Airways.
Oh,
they owe them millions of dollars because they paid them to get that. That makes sense, that catalog in the backseat. And I guess it just stopped working. I think you're right. I think people use their digital devices and they don't read what's in the backseat.
No. And also now you can shop on Amazon and you can you would look in a Sky Mall catalog and then write the thing down
and go to Amazon.
You go to Amazon and buy it cheaper.
Well, Sky Mall, the delivery was weird. You had to pay extra if you wanted to have it sometime in this century. There was all sorts of weird stuff about Sky Mall, and their prices were not competitive. And
not
I think
at
in
all.
The internet era, you could figure that out.
Not at all. I remember once you were trying to buy something and you said, oops, I just bought 15 of them.
I did. It was little miniature helicopters.
The helicopter.
And yeah. I didn't realize I bought 15 until they arrived. I thought I bought one. I have some Sky Mall stuff here. You may remember this. This is I'm going through my studio. This is the Chinese gong.
That's very funny. Someone tweeted, Leo should ring the gong as the death knell.
Well, remember when I got the gong and I rang it and it didn't? Well, let me let you hear it. It sounds like I'm hitting a frying pan. It's the worst.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe that also had something to do with it.
No, we're not going to miss them terribly.
It's like a garbage can lid that I purchased for, it was expensive.
I think it was like, was it like 70 or 80 bucks?
What other things did we buy? I bought a lot of stuff on Sky Mall. I didn't buy that on Sky Mall.
The human slingshot.
The human slingshot was great. It was a big rubber tube that you get four people in, and then you'd run around and bounce off of each other. It was really a recipe for death and disaster.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Jamma B lives in the studio, and they used that to get him home.
We'd shoot him home, yeah.
Shoot Jamma B home, yeah.
I am not a compulsive shopper. I did this for the purposes of entertainment on the podcast Dick does, which he still does, and there's still a lot of junk on it. It's called The Giz Whiz, and you can see it on the podcast network, twit.tv/DGW. Dick, have a great week. You all have a great week. I'll see you next time. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows and Windows Weekly, Macintosh and MacBreak Weekly, iPad and iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.